This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington.
What do you want to change? What do you want to now? What do you want to change? What do you want to now?
On Friday, activists around the world gathered for what is being called the largest climate rally in history. An estimated 4 million people participated. At the center of the global strikes is one key figure, 16-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg. The strikes are only one milestone in the international fight against climate change that Thunberg and so many other young activists have championed. Today we continue our series, No Plan B, and we'll hear from three young activists about their fights against the climate crisis. Before we get to what they have taught us, we want to spend a little time talking about what we have taught them in school. These days, teachers often have the job of being the first ones to educate young people about climate change and its effects. But what does that lesson look like? How can our teachers educate students into action instead of into fear and distress? Joining us now is 1A's Catherine Fink. She spent some time at an institute for educators about teaching climate change. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Joshua.
Tell us a bit more about the institute that you attended.
So last month, I spent some time at the Lowell School here in D.C. They were hosting an Institute for Climate Change Education for Teachers in the Humanities with Climate Generation, a nonprofit based in Minneapolis, and NOAA's Climate Office, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And their whole approach was that they want climate change to be taught in the classroom in an interdisciplinary fashion. Climate change is not new, but we're no longer at this point where we can act like climate change exists in a vacuum. It touches, you know, everything we learn and how we feel and write and emote and think through every subject. So I spoke with Natalie Stapert, who's a language arts teacher at the Lowell School, and she told me about the school's unique interdisciplinary curriculum that centers around climate change. And by interdisciplinary, I mean learning about climate change through fiction workshops and storytelling and field trips out in the community and talking about climate change through the lens of art or role-playing exercises even of UN negotiations. She said her students have read nonfiction books such as The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind and A Long Walk to Water, and also dystopian fiction like Exodus and The Giver. And the idea is that the students would start to think about climate change and what the world could be like. And here's part of what she told me.
Now, when the students are reading those, what they're doing is they're practicing vocabulary, they're practicing comprehension, they're practicing determining importance, summarizing, all those language arts skills that you would be teaching regardless of what book it is, but with a book that has a climate theme. When they write, you know, when we teach persuasive writing, we write letters to family members, to elected officials, sometimes to the media to ask them to cover climate more. When we do informational writing, the students choose a topic under climate change and they do a research report on that. And then there's also a narrative component, which is their own dystopian idea of a future world where climate is being addressed. A lot of schools have to use a lot of external motivators to help students stay focused and achieve. Grades are one, rewards, tickets, all those kinds of things. When the content of the teaching is something that is really relevant to children, you don't need those things in the same way. You have fewer problems with behavior. You have fewer problems with completion of work, meeting of the objectives, because kids are so eager to engage and to do their best because it really matters. It's not something that matters only for the teacher or only for the class. It matters in the real world.
So that's Natalie Stapert, a language arts teacher at the Lowell School. And I like what she said, Catherine, about making it relevant to children because climate change is global, but it's also local. So I imagine that teachers shared with you about how they tailored that climate change curriculum to reflect what students see and what they feel right around them.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the 14th year that this Climate Institute has been put on. And every year, they have, you know, around 50 teachers who are coming from all over the country. So folks coming from the Midwest, from both coasts, and that really impacts how they teach climate change in their classroom. And they incorporate field trips where students can go out and really see and experience this hands-on approach and understand the tangible impact of climate change. I also spoke with Caitlin Thompson, who is a high school social studies teacher in Montgomery County, Maryland. And I asked her how she educates her students about these vastly different effects of climate change and what impact they can have on a region, especially when some aren't visible or noticeable where she lives. And here's what she said.
Honestly, I think it's a double-edged sword. My kids get an opportunity to see a little bit more of the immediate impact because they've been to the beach, they've been to the mountains. You know, we're local, so we're close enough to see a lot of what's going on. Alternatively, because we are so suburban and so close to areas that are urban, you know, being in this Northeast megalopolis, my kids don't understand farming. They don't understand the impact of land use for agriculture, land use for animal raising, you know, and what that means for what we're doing to the planet. And that, because land use is such a big part of climate change, that's a big challenge because it's hard for the kids to connect to it. Especially with youth, anecdotal evidence is the best way to get a kid engaged in a topic. Kids really struggle with global scale statistics. Kids really struggle with this big map that's turning red. They can't identify with that, but they can identify with a kid who used to have water running through his backyard and now doesn't, or with a kid who used to live in farmland and is now breathing in smog. You know, they can identify with stories. So looking for both global and local stories, things that you can bring to life for the kids, is really the most effective way to get them involved. And then once they're bought in, then bringing in the science, bringing in the numbers, bringing in the solutions.
That's social studies teacher Caitlin Thompson from Montgomery County, Maryland. Catherine, what kinds of districts did these teachers come from? I imagine they're from all over the country. Were most of them from districts that supported their interest in teaching climate change, or were any of them facing resistance to bringing that into the classroom?
So it was definitely a mixed bag, but I would say for the most part, the teachers I spoke with did have a lot of support from their school and from their school district to sort of bolster their climate change curriculum. But not everyone I spoke with came from an area where man-made climate change is accepted as fact. I spoke with one teacher, Belhika Cucalone, who's an English teacher in Florida. And here's what she told me about her students in her area.
Youth are kind of moving that conversation towards climate crisis and climate action. I think Florida, unfortunately, has kind of a long history of climate denial in our legislature. That's changing, but also just in the community at large with families, perhaps not having themselves had that education about climate change when they were in school. And so I worry as an educator that as I have them become advocates, they won't be able to go out and have that, the tools to successfully change hearts and minds. I mean, we deal with flooding all the time, hurricanes, heat. I mean, I think all of the very visible features of climate change are seen in Florida at every level. And so for me, it's always been frustrating to see such layers of climate denial. And I think what's really cool is that as an educator, I get to kind of impact that change in the youth and the culture. And then they go out like little mini ambassadors into their community and change kind of the hearts of people. Almost like you can't deny what's happening. Like every year, the evacuations become more severe. The flooding becomes more troublesome to communities, even in central Florida. So that now it's about our youth becoming many advocates for climate action, but also them disseminating that information to their families so that there's more understanding, so that then it's not them just being advocates, but their families too.
That's Belhika Cucalone, who teaches English in the state of Florida. Catherine, I think one of the things that folks look to young people for is hope in climate activism. It's one of the things that Greta Thunberg kind of smacked the UN for, expecting kids to be the source of hope. But were the teachers hopeful? Were the students hopeful? What was your sense when you walked away from the Institute about their general mood?
So I asked each teacher about this, about hope and positivity in their messaging, and they all seemed pretty hopeful. They talked a lot about the power of positivity around climate change for their students, but also for themselves. And here's what some of them told me.
If I teach it in a more positive manner, I'm seeing a lot more engagement, and my students getting excited about going out into the community and talking to others.
Our goal as educators is to empower young people, to make them resilient and empowered to deal with the world's greatest issues, and right now climate change is a big one.
Reiterating to them that the small actions that they're able to take add up to big actions collectively.
The change in our world needs to be vast and it needs to be quick. And so I'm looking at students who are ready to learn more and be active sooner rather than later.
Honestly, you can't go to work in a school building every day without hope. So hope's the only thing that's going to keep us smiling and teaching and charging ahead.
The voices of teachers at an institute about teaching climate change in the classroom, as reported by 1A's Catherine Fink. Catherine, thanks for sharing their stories with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll shift gears and go from the teachers to the students, the young people, and we'll hear from three young climate activists about the work they are doing to fight climate change. We'll also get to some of your stories about what's happening in your community with young people and the support they're getting, or maybe the resistance they're facing. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rothy's. Rothy's are the stylish, comfortable, and sustainable flats seamlessly crafted from repurposed plastic bottles. Available in a range of colors, patterns, and styles, like flats, loafers, and sneakers. Fully machine washable and no break-in period. Discover why BuzzFeed called them their forever shoes. Rothy's always offers free shipping and free returns and exchanges. Go to rothys.com/1A to find out more.
An incident in Nashville that shocked the Latino community. A computer designed to control the entire Chilean economy. A Martian invasion in Ecuador. Radio Ambulante is back with a brand new season. NPR's Spanish language podcast will take you around Latin America to show you the fascinating, strange, and compelling stories of the region. Subscribe and listen every Tuesday.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're continuing our series, No Plan B, about the climate crisis. We just heard from educators about how they teach climate change to young people. Now let's switch gears and talk to young people about what they can teach us. First, we wanted to play some of yesterday's speech by 16-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg. Her remarks at the UN Climate Action Summit drew immense praise and a few cruel insults from cable news commentators. Here are a few minutes of what Greta Thunberg had to say.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you? For more than 30 years, the science has been crystal clear. How dare you continue to look away and come here saying that you're doing enough when the politics and solutions needed are still nowhere in sight? You say you hear us and that you understand the urgency. But no matter how sad and angry I am, I do not want to believe that. Because if you really understood the situation and still kept on failing to act, then you would be evil, and that I refuse to believe. The popular idea of cutting our emissions in half in 10 years only gives us a 50% chance of staying below 1.5 degrees and the risk of setting off irreversible chain reactions beyond human control. 50% may be acceptable to you, but those numbers do not include tipping points, most feedback loops, additional warming hidden by toxic air pollution, or the aspects of equity and climate justice. They also rely on my generation sucking hundreds of billions of tons of your CO2 out of the air with technologies that barely exist. So a 50% risk is simply not acceptable to us, we who have to live with the consequences.
That was Greta Thunberg speaking yesterday at the UN Climate Action Summit. Now let's meet three young people who are working to make a difference in saving our planet. Joining us from London is Anissa Khan. She's a 23-year-old climate activist and the executive director of Sustain Us, a nonprofit youth-led advocacy group focusing on justice and sustainability. Anissa, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thank you.
Joining us in studio is Madeline Graham. She's a 16-year-old environmental activist based in Maryland. She's also a participant with Fridays for Future, an international movement of students striking during school days to demand action against climate change. Madeline, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And joining us from New York is Carl Smith, a 17-year-old environmental activist based in Akiak, Alaska. Carl, glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me here.
Let me begin with the three of you and just get a sense of how you came to this movement. Madeline, how did you get involved in environmental activism?
When I was quite small, I learned about climate change and I was very concerned about it. But it was recently that I realized, you know, it's not just about the trees. There are people that are dying. People are dying right now. And that was when I really realized that I had to do something.
Were there certain things in particular that you were noticing in your environment, Madeline, that worried you?
Absolutely. I was noticing, well, first of all, in Ellicott City, Maryland, we have seen two pretty much 1,000-year floods in the past couple of years, which have been devastating, of course. But then, in addition, in my own environment, my friends were afraid. They were telling me they were afraid. I was afraid. My generation and my classmates were crippled by anxiety of something that they often felt they had no control over.
Carl, I understand you're a member of the Yupik tribe in Alaska, and you've been speaking out about how climate change has affected your tribe's way of life. You are part of a group of kids from across the globe who filed a complaint to the UN to demand accountability for violating the human rights of children due to climate change. I'm curious to know when you started to notice the effects of climate change in your village. Were there one or two things that caught your attention that made you know that there was a problem?
I started noticing when it started getting more warm and raining during the winter, and people were just falling through the ice. And I wanted to do something because we're not going to be able to go on the ice anymore. We're not going to be able to do our subsistence life.
And just so I can understand, Carl, can you just explain a little more about the environment where you live? Are there other kinds of plants or animals that are kind of essential to the environment where you live that are starting to be affected?
Like there's cloudberries, blueberries, raspberries, all the berries that we pick, we use it to make like our cultural desserts.
And I imagine that's fairly distressing to see those all be affected by climate change. I'm also curious, yeah. Anissa Khan, what you've noticed. You grew up, as I understand it, in Amman, which is the capital of Jordan, and have seen climate change from the front lines of where you live. What did you first start to notice in Amman that got your attention?
Yeah, so I actually grew up in Oman, in Muscat, its capital, so different country, but it was a wild experience. We lived at the heart of the fossil fuel industry, so about 80% of the country's economy was based on petroleum development, and oil was about 10 times cheaper than drinking water. And so I think seeing this kind of investment in the fossil fuel industry really impacted me growing up because we lived in a place that was extremely hot. It was about 100 degrees every day, and there were times during the day where you couldn't even be outside to work because you could die. And we continue in the country, you know, continues to extract fossil fuels like many other places in the world. And at the same time, my family, my parents, and I come from the southeast coast of India, from Chennai, which is a place that is constantly being hit by droughts and floods and droughts and floods. We're currently living through the sixth month of our city not having water. That's 7 million people not having water. And by the year 2030, about 40% of India won't have access to water. And so to me, it's such a harsh lived experience, the climate crisis. And so I think it's very obvious to see the way it's impacting people.
Anissa, first of all, I want to just correct. You said that you grew up in the nation of Oman, not the city of Amman. Is that right?
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay. Sorry about that. Sorry we got that wrong. But what was the moment when you decided that you had to do something, that you had to get involved?
A really formative moment for me was that I went to College of the Atlantic in the U.S. in Maine. And through College of the Atlantic, I started attending the UN climate conferences since the time I was 18. And at these conferences, similar to what Greta was saying in the clip that you played, I saw so much injustice. The fact that developed countries like the United States and the fossil fuel industry are the biggest historical emitters of greenhouse gases, but the people who are feeling the impacts of climate change the hardest are the most innocent in its causation. It's women, people of color, indigenous people, low-income families, young people, and people like my family in the developing world. And I remember sitting in the room while the Paris Agreement was being negotiated on and it being super late at night and watching countries, you know, fight over nitty-gritties in the text. And at the same time, knowing that back home in Chennai, there was a huge hurricane and floods where 300 people died. And I didn't hear from people that I loved for quite some time. And I don't think I ever remember feeling that scared and angry and hurt. And to me, that was, even though I've been working on this for some time, it was really the moment where I was like, I cannot wait for governments and industry to create the political will to work on this. This is up to me and other people and elders who have been organizing for climate justice for decades now.
Eddie emailed, I am both encouraged and disheartened that Greta Thunberg, with English as a second language, is more eloquent and presents more coherent arguments than our U.S. president. The president did tweet out a link to what Greta said with a somewhat sarcastic remark connected to it. Madeline, I wonder what your take is on Greta Thunberg. How do you view her and her activism?
I think Greta Thunberg has definitely been an inspiration to me and to a lot of my friends. If she lived here, she would actually be in my grade. So it's very to look at someone like that and see yourself, that's always going to be very inspiring. And of course, you know, she is, of course, building on the work of that activists have been doing for years. But I think that with the platform that she is getting, she is using it in the best way in order to bring light to this issue. She doesn't mince words. She says it exactly the way that it is. Her speech at the UN, it actually brought me to tears as well, because she's absolutely right. How dare you? You know, how dare you know that you've known for years? How dare you do nothing? And it's to be able to look world leaders in the eye, to watch someone like you look world leaders in the eye and say, how dare you? It's very empowering, because I think that there are a lot of youth that want to say that.
So you kind of see yourself through Greta's eyes.
Yes.
I want to continue talking about some of the work that the three of you are doing, and we'll get to some more of your questions and stories in a minute. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. From Connecticut to California, from Mississippi to Minnesota, millions of American businesses are using Google tools to grow online. The Grow with Google initiative supports small businesses by providing free digital skills workshops and one-on-one coaching in all 50 states, helping businesses get online, connect with new customers, and work more productively. Learn more at google.com/grow.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
How do you take a single idea and turn it into a billion-dollar empire, even against all odds? I'm Guy Raz, and every Monday on NPR's How I Built This, I speak with the innovators behind the world's most influential brands. Listen and subscribe right now.
Back now to our conversation with Madeline Graham, Carl Smith, and Anissa Khan. Glad to have gotten some of your stories, particularly young activists who are involved in the fight against climate change. Here's what one listener left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Tony. I'm a youth activist working in Oak Park, Illinois. What I'd like to say about the climate crisis is that it is not one single issue. It is an intersectional issue that impacts all of us in a multitude of ways, from wealth inequality to infrastructure, to immigration, to food scarcity, weather disasters, indigenous rights, and the harmful effects done to communities of color. by addressing the climate crisis and working together to solve it, we can do the most holistic good for the entire planet.
Tony, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. Thank you very much. Carl Smith, could you talk about the conversations that go on within your tribe, particularly with your tribal leaders, about the change in climate and what can be done? What's that been like?
We're talking about erosion. Like, we're finding out, like, there has been a lot of storms this summer, like really windy from the south winds, and they just get big waves, and my village is eroding away. It's going to take my home away, and we're trying to find a way to stop it, like a seawall, or we tried using sandbags and like those big tarps and whatever, but it didn't work. They're just the waves are too strong. They're moving six homes just right now because it's about to fall in the river, and mainly everybody's fish camps that are by the river, they're about to fall in or already fell in.
Is there any sense, Carl, of how much longer your village can hold on? Like, are we talking about a few years? Hopefully not a few months, but like, how much longer can your village hold on?
We don't know. There's like about 60 to 80 feet that's already lost.
60 to 80 feet of coastline, you mean?
Of the riverbank.
Okay. So once you kind of lose the riverbank, then people basically have to move away, yeah. Find other places to sustain themselves?
Like in Newtok, their village is eroding away, and that now they have to find a different location in Alaska. They have to find a different location so that they can still live their way of life. So we don't want to do that. We want to stay where we know that place, and we want to stay where we made memories.
So basically we're talking about everyone would have to pick up everything and find a new home, like build a new home, basically, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anissa, talk to us about your work with Sustain Us and with the United Nations. Anissa, what does Sustain Us do?
We're a community of young people between the ages of 18 and 29 from diverse geographies and identities across the U.S., from young people on the front lines of the fires burning down California to Indigenous youth from the Navajo Nation. And we train one another in nonviolent direct action, media, and climate policy skills so that we can organize together for climate justice. And so for almost two decades now, Sustain Us has been sending young people who are organizing for climate justice in their communities to international conferences on the environment and things related to the environment. So we go to the United Nations climate conferences, to the World Bank meetings. We have people in New York right now organizing along with Greta and others at the UN climate summit that's happening. And I think we truly believe that those of us on the front lines of crisis are the forefront of change. And so we show up in these spaces to hold governments accountable to the promises that they make and to expose the influence of the fossil fuel industry. The fossil fuel industry has had a stranglehold over the UN climate talks for longer than I've been alive or anyone else, and Sustain Us has been alive. Shell even bragged about how they wrote parts of the Paris Agreement, which blows my mind that a corporation that has spent millions of dollars to deny the climate crisis wrote a part of the agreement that was, you know, written to save the planet.
Madeline, talk to us about your work with Fridays for Future. What's the organization's goal?
So Fridays for Future is an international movement on which children strike from school on Fridays with the ultimate goal of climate action following the Paris Climate Agreement, reducing emissions in time based upon the science, listening to the science.
How's that gone when you ask your parents and your principal and your teachers, like, hey, we're not showing up on this Friday or next Friday or the Friday after that? How's that been received?
It's not been awesome. our school has been a little more accommodating than some, I think, have been. They don't excuse our absences. Work that we miss is a zero in the grade book. But, you know, they don't stop us. They did give us a police escort when we walked out last time because we did have a couple hundred people who walked out.
That's a big choice to make, though, that you just decide, you know, you got to kind of calculate, okay, how many zeros can I afford to get in all my classes?
Why would I study for a future that's not going to exist? Why would I stay in school when people who have already finished school and have had people with multiple Ivy League degrees refuse to act? That's not what I want for my future. I want a livable future. I want to be able to, in good conscience, have children. I want to know that people who have done the least to cause the climate crisis are no longer being ravaged. And if that means a couple zeros in the grade book, or that means a couple Fridays off from school, or today off from school, I'm missing world history for the second time in a row, but I can make peace with that. I'm okay with that.
What kinds of reactions have you gotten, Madeline, to these walkouts? Have they been mostly negative, positive, confused? What do people say?
So in my area, which is, you know, we usually walk out to D.C. Because we are kind of on the edge of Maryland and D.C. It's been generally positive, generally supportive from people, you know, commuters. Sometimes people honk at us while we walk by, like, in support. But in other parts of the U.S., and other parts of the world, Fridays for Future strikers have definitely not been received so well. There have been people, you know, the biggest thing is go back to class. You know, you need to be in school. You shouldn't be doing this. This isn't your problem. Well, it shouldn't be our problem, but it is. So if you're not going to act, then we're going to keep walking out regardless of what you say.
I wonder, Madeline, how do you keep up hope for the future? I mean, I know that you said that hearing Greta Thunberg speak really affected you because you felt the same way and you saw yourself through her eyes. What gives you hope, if anything, for the future?
So first and foremost, the thing that drives my activism is I believe that we are going to win. I believe that the youth will win. Because as Greta Thunberg said in her speech, I do not believe that world leaders are evil. I refuse to believe that they are evil. And I think that one day, they're going to have to look us children, they're going to have to look my children in the eye. And we are going to ask, is it worth it? Is your money and your greed and your power worth our childhoods and our lives? And I think that I think they are going to say no. I think that there is going to be a reckoning. I think that people are every day realizing that they have been betrayed, that their leaders are not doing what they were supposed to do. They are not protecting them. And I think that very soon we are going to see a revolution. We are going to see people are going to rise up and the youth are going to win. I truly believe that.
Carl, what about you? What gives you hope that this is going to be okay, if anything?
What gives me hope is the people that care. They want to help us out. They want to do everything they can to help us out. And yeah.
And Anissa, what about you? What gives you hope?
A couple of things give me hope. The fact that it's a question of survival of people that I love and my family gives me the hope that I will want to continue in this movement. It is elders and allies and young people, especially from Black, Brown, Indigenous communities who have been fighting for decades that give me hope. And I think finally, the thing that gives me the most hope is the thing that we talk about very little. And it's that all that we have to gain because of the climate crisis, it's giving us an unyielding deadline, but also historic opportunity. And as we're trying to get our emissions down and save the world that we live in, we're being given a chance to push for policies that can dramatically improve our lives, that can close the gap between the rich and poor, that can create a large number of jobs and reinvigorate the way that we live. And while bringing together in an intersectional way all of our strong movements for justice, for Indigenous rights, for gender justice, for jobs and for welfare. And that's what gives me hope, is that there's so much for us to win. And it means a lot.
Hey, before we go, Madeline, if you could give a word of advice very briefly to a young person who's thinking about getting involved in climate activism but isn't quite sure if they know what to do, if they know where to start, is there something that you've learned through your activism that you would want other young people to know?
As soon as you as a young person realize that you are capable and you have more power than you ever thought you would, and you are brave enough and you are smart enough and you're capable, that's when it clicks. You just have to remember, you have to know you're capable of so much more than you know.
Madeline Graham, an environmental activist based in Maryland and a participant in Fridays for Future. Madeline, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Carl Smith, an environmental activist and a member of the Yupik tribe in Akiak, Alaska. Carl, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
And Anissa Khan, a climate activist and the executive director of Sustain Us. Thanks, Anissa.
Thank you so much.
This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.